I'm JP Tuesday.
And I'm Kiki Cannon. We've been Disney fans our entire lives. And now, as childless adults, we're undertaking a journey through the media that shaped our lives.
Trying to find out if what made them special is still there.
We are Rewatching the Magic.
Ahoy there, Kiki.
Our Tuesday.
We still be in talk like a pirate month.
Avast there, me hearty. We're having a party. It's talk like a pirate
month.
Yo-ho!
And this is talk like a pirate week.
Yeah, this Friday, the 9th. Is it Friday or Saturday?
I believe it's Saturday.
Yeah, Saturday the 19th is International Talk Like a Pirate Day. You can look it up.
It's a real holiday, darn it.
It is. Not only it is a real holiday, it is technically a religious holiday.
Yes, it is. In the religion of Pastafarianism, it is the highest holy day.
Yes, as they worship the flying spaghetti monster.
I have a very lovely knitted flying spaghetti monster on my desk right now, actually. It was a gift from our friend Janice. So thank you, Janice, if you're listening.
So yes, we are talking about Pirates of the Caribbean, The Curse of the Black Pearl.
Woo-hoo.
The second movie that was based off an attraction at a Disney park.
Yes. However, can we pause for a second? Because there's some other Disney news that's happened this past week, maybe? Or in the past couple of weeks, maybe?
Sure. We can talk about that for a minute.
Yeah, so Mulan came out on Disney Plus.
Yeah.
And as I mentioned in last week's episode, I received it, the premiere access, as a birthday gift.
All right. Well, I have not seen the film yet. I'm a little low on funds at the moment. But when I get around to it, I will likely pick it up and view the movie. So can you give us a little non-spoiler review of the film?
Yeah, it's freaking fantastic. If you've been on the internet since it actually dropped, you are going to think, if you have not seen it, that this is the most awful movie ever. The entire internet is screaming dishonor on Disney's cow at this point, and I don't know why. It feels like being gaslighted by the entire internet. Everybody in my household loved it. We watched it. We thought it was great.
A lot of it, I mean, it's either going to be, it's not the original movie, it's not, well, what they consider the original movie, even though Disney didn't create this character. It's some, you know, the various political issues that were going on within China at the time of the filming, locations that may or may not have been problematic. But you have to,
you know, I'm going to speak to that because I fully understand that. I have made my own personal ethical decisions about watching the film. You are free to disagree, and I feel that there is really good points to be made on the side of people who are boycotting this for political or economic reason. Mm-hmm. And if you have chosen to do that, more power to you. I wish you well. I have made my own choices for my own reasons after, you know, looking into it. However, if you are going to decide to give this movie a pass because some, you know, movie reviewer on the internet was screaming dishonor unto Disney, please don't. If you would have watched this movie otherwise and now you're hearing reviewers just do nonsense online, please do not listen to them. Just watch the film. Make up your own mind. If you don't like it, that's fine. It's always fine. Taste is personal. Okay. But I think a lot of the problems that are being brought up are born of mainly sexism, to be honest. It's a little bit different to watch an animated woman lead a film than it is to watch a real life woman, because then you have to deal with like real life women existing and having agency.
Oh, so it's another Captain Marvel situation.
I actually watched a review. I'm not even going to bother to name the reviewer. Pretty prominent reviewer at one point, though. And all he did was scream the exact same nonsense that I heard levied at Rey in the Star Wars films and Captain Marvel specifically. It is the exact same thing. She's too perfect. She doesn't have a character arc. All of her acting is wooden. And that is nonsense on all points. There is a character arc. It's a very good character arc. I think the actress does an amazing job playing the character. It's a subtle performance. You know, she's not screaming and, you know, whatever. But, okay. It is appropriate for a woman in China at that period of time. You know, I mean, that's how she would have been socialized. The other thing you're going to hear is, oh, now Mulan's got superpowers. And no, she really doesn't. I'm gonna tell you real quick. There is a genre in China called wuxia. And what it is it's a blend of martial arts, like a kung fu film. You know, like Bruce Lee film, okay, but mixed with medieval fantasy in China. So you do get more like magic, and the martial arts skill is heightened beyond what a real person could achieve. So there's a lot of wire work.
It's very Crouching Tiger.
It is exactly Crouching Tiger. That is actually probably the best known example of wuxia as a genre in the West.
Or the Disney Power Ranger seasons.
Yeah. And if you... I am by far no expert on the genre, even though I am a fan of it. But if you look at Mulan, I immediately, just in kind of my passing knowledge of it, I immediately was like, this is a wuxia film. Like, fully.
Wirefu. I've also heard called Wirefu.
Yeah, you can hear it. But there are some specific things about the way they talk about the code of honor, the placement of family, the specific things that Mulan can and cannot do, you know, physically in the film. You know, there is actual magic in the film. There is a character who is a witch. That is not Mulan, okay? So, you know, if you would watch a Three Stooges movie and not get mad that they get hit on the head with a 2x4 and don't suffer a, you know, life-ending concussion or something, then don't be mad at this. It's what the genre is, okay? If you can accept it as that, as this is Disney's first entry into a genre you are not familiar with, I think you will enjoy it. As a fan of that genre, I thought this was brilliant. And Chinese cinema has been making films about Mulan in the style of what we consider the wuxia genre since the silent era of film. So maybe learn your history before you start screaming about this comes from nowhere and Disney's doing something crazy with it.
I mean, there was a live action. Yeah, there was a live action Mulan about a decade or so ago that was sounds very similar to what you're saying.
It's been more recent than that they've done it in China. But yeah, there have been a long list of Mulan films and TV series and opera. And I mean, this is the most retold story in China, basically. So, yeah, go watch it. And whether you like it or not, that's a personal issue. But don't write it off because, you know, some ignorant dude on the internet says that it's horrible. I loved it. I'm going to watch it again. I'm going to watch it 400 more times. It's brilliant. All right. And Ming-Na Wen does have a cameo in it. So keep an eye out for her.
So the OG Disney Mulan does have
an appearance. OG Disney Mulan does have an on-screen appearance in this Mulan film. So.
Oh, great. Agent May's time traveling again.
Yeah, she looks amazing in the film, too. Woo, so good. Anyway, but back to Pirates.
Yes, Pirates of the Caribbean. This was the second film based off a Disney attraction, the first being The Country Bears. Yep. In fact, this movie almost got shut down because of the reaction to the Country Bears. That the Country Bears pretty much bombed at the box office, and Eisner was like, that's it. Shut it down. We're not doing any more movies based off attractions. This is not what people want. And keep in mind that the movie was being filmed at the time.
And, however,
they didn't. They didn't shut the yeah. movie down, and we got this this movie. And, yeah, I haven't seen the movie in a while, and this was actually enjoyable, again, to see this for the first time in several years.
I'm going to say that I sort of get where Eisner was coming from. That's one of the few times I will ever say that in my life. However, I am glad they didn't, because this is like the only good thing they've produced out of a Disney attraction, I think.
Keep in mind that 1 year after this came out would be The Haunted Mansion.
Which, possibly even worse than The Country Bears.
And, you know,
That's up for grabs, though. That's like a coin
and
flip.
We were supposed to get the Jungle Cruise this year if you know, the pandemic hadn't hit. Who knows what that would have done.
I forgot about that. That looked awful.
And there was, at one point, plans for a movie based off It's a Small World.
That would be a nightmare. That is a waking nightmare. I will have a literal, actual dreaming nightmares about that tonight, now that I've heard that.
Based on what I've been able to find out about that, it pretty much would have been Around the World in 80 Days.
Yeah, don't do that. Also, that song. Don't ever use that song again. Maybe just take it out of the original attraction.
So, you are probably the only person on this podcast that have probably ridden the earliest known version of the Pirates of the Caribbean ride, because I didn't ride it until 2 years ago after they made all the changes.
Yeah, no, I do believe I did. I would have ridden it first roughly
30 years ago.
Well, no, a little bit earlier than that. I think I was about 5 the first time. So like 86, 87, maybe. And then I rode it again in the early 90s, about 93.
So way before, way before this movie ever was even thought of.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Way, way, way before. And I rode it in Florida. So that would have been the, you know. Mm-hmm. The OG version of the ride, I believe. I don't think they'd made any major changes to the animatronics or the storyline between opening and the times I rode it.
Yeah. Yeah, by the time I rode it, again, it was 2 years ago. They had already added Jack Sparrow. They had already changed up the redhead to be Red the Pirate. She was actually walking around the park. So all the changes that they've made since then to add elements of this movie, because after the movie came out, the ride became really, really popular, and people were complaining that there was not enough of what they saw in the movie in the ride.
Yeah, however, there is a lot of the OG ride in this movie.
Yeah, and that was one of the things that Eisner was afraid of that he didn't think that... that there was too much of the ride in here, especially after the reaction to the Country Bears, that maybe tone it down a bit. And we do get some references. We get the song many times in the movie. We get the dog with the key.
That is my favorite part. When I originally saw that my first time watching this film, I lost my mind. I was like, that is beautiful. I love everything about it. do that, yeah.
I think that's the only ones that I can name off the top of my head. It's the song.
Almost everything in the Tortuga scene is from the OG version of the ride. Mm-hmm. The woman pouring liquor into the guy's mouth as he's trying to, you know, drink from two different mugs and all that kind of stuff. The redhead that slaps Jack upon coming to Tortuga is, I do believe, supposed to be the redhead from the original winch auction that they later turned into a pirate. And there's a few other set pieces, like there are some people dangling from the balconies and stuff in Tortuga that you see when you go through the ride. At least originally, I don't really know what it looks like now, but all that stuff was stuff I remembered from
the version that, again, I don't know if this was in the original or not, probably not. When I went to Disneyland a few years ago, they added an effect where you actually see a skeleton, and as you pass by it, it turns human. I don't know if that was an original effect or was that inspired by the movie.
I think that was inspired by the movie. I don't remember that necessarily. I'm not the park expert, of course, by any means. We have friends who are, but
yeah.
But I am not among them. I missed this in theaters when it first came out because of stuff like Country Bears. And then they're like, now we're doing Pirates of the Caribbean. And I was like, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard of. I can't imagine. And then I started hearing, like, you know, it's breaking box office records and everybody loves it. And people are going nuts over Johnny Depp in this and everything. So we rented it the second it came out on DVD. Because there were still movie rental places at the time. That wasn't even Redbox. I was like, for real brick and mortar store. Yeah. Probably not Blockbuster. We had a video warehouse in town and that was my favorite place to go. They had a better selection, really good, wrestling collection and really good horror movie collection. Blockbuster was kind of thin on that. Anyway.
Yeah.
But yeah, so, I kind of kicked myself for missing this in the theater because when I saw it at home, it was really good. So,
yeah,
you wanna get into it?
Let's get into it. Let's get into our cast. I guess we can go into that.
We've already mentioned the big star, Johnny Depp,
and he was not even the first person that Disney wanted because Hugh Jackman, Matthew McConaughey. I'm glad they didn't go with Christopher Walken, especially after Country Bears.
I think Christopher Walken might have made a good Barbossa, but I honestly think Christopher Walken was a little too old for some of the things they needed Jack Sparrow to do in this film. Not any dig on Christopher Walken by any means. That man is still in good health and spry last I saw of him, but
the last time I saw Christopher Walken, he was actually playing a pirate. He played Captain Hook on that NBC Peter Pan Live a few years ago.
But I do think that he, you know, Johnny Depp is the exact right age group. You can believe that he would have been a pirate with somebody that is Jeffrey Rush's age, but you can also buy him as youthful enough to really connect with Orlando Bloom and Keira Knightley. Mm-hmm. So he's the exact right, you know, right in that kind of sweet spot of the age where he's not too old that he becomes like this weird, creepy father figure to the two younger ones. But you also can't say, like, why was Barbossa ever following this young whelp, you know? So yeah. I think if you go any farther with the age difference, it would become a little weird. I would have been very interested to see Hugh Jackman's take on this. I would not have been interested to see somebody like Matthew McConaughey or Christopher Walken in this part. Christopher Walken in a different part, yes, but yeah, I think that Johnny Depp ended up being the exact right person, which is hilarious because everybody hated him.
Yeah, even Eisner didn't really want him in there.
Well, I agree with Eisner on almost nothing, and Eisner started screaming, "He's ruining my movie." So, no, he saved your movie. This movie would have like 80% less interesting without Johnny
and,
Depp.
You know, Jack Sparrow pretty much becomes the most popular character in this franchise.
Yeah, and they have a franchise because of Jack Sparrow. This would not have been a franchise movie on the back of anybody else.
And as a one and done, it wouldn't have been too bad. But the fact that it became a franchise is solely because of Johnny Depp's performance as Jack Sparrow. Let's not lie about that.
Yeah. Just moving on, because we'll get into the character stuff in a bit, but just moving on with the cast, we got Jeffrey Rush as our villain, Barbossa. It would have been interesting to see Hugh Jackman and Jeffrey Rush play off each other, as they are both Australian, and that would have been an interesting dynamic, but Hugh Jackman was only really known for Wolverine
at that point.
And so he wasn't really considered a
the star man he is now.
You hang a franchise on at the time. Then we have Orlando Bloom, who had just come off Lord of the Rings and was the new hotness.
Yep.
When this was made, I mean, everything was Orlando Bloom at the time. Apparently he's only in the movie because he was working on a film with Jeffrey Rush, and they sent Jeffrey Rush the script, and Jeffrey Rush was like, hey kid, you should read this. And then Orlando Bloom wanted in. Keira Knightley was really only known before this, I think, because of Bend It Like Beckham, which was not a huge hit in the US. It's a great film, by the way, if you've never seen it. But it was a big hit in England, and a kind of minor. It was one of those things that if you're like a film buff or a, you know, kind of Anglophile, which I am both, you heard about it and you'd have people say like, "Yeah, you should watch this." But it wasn't like a big hit in the U.S.
And to connect it to something else, she also was Natalie Portman's body double for the Star Wars Episode One.
Well, that is true, but you don't really know it's her.
It's true.
Because she looks so much like Natalie Portman, and especially under that makeup and everything. So people just thought that they just filmed Natalie Portman twice. I don't think anybody knew it was like another real person for a while until Keira Knightley got famous for other things. And then people were like, oh, hey, did you know that? Because, you know, we're both massive Star Wars fans, and I don't think either of us knew it until after she got famous. She I know I did. But yeah, so she had done Bend It Like Beckham, and of course she had been in the background of the Star Wars prequel, but that was about it. This was her big role. This was what made her a star. We got another kind of major British actor, well, you know, Welsh, in Jonathan Pryce playing her father. Really, I adore him. He is so well known if you know anything about theater and musical theater, but he's also been in Evita. He was in Tomorrow Never Dies, the Bond film, as a villain in that. He's always, you know, he's Jonathan Pryce. He shows up in everything. You know him. Anyway, and the one kind of interesting one that I was shocked to see was Jack Davenport, who I knew from Coupling. He's Norrington,
the fiance
of Keira Knightley. You know, the annoying naval officer. He's since gone on to be like, he shows up for a little bit in the first Kingsman movie. He was on the TV show Smash as a major character and stuff, but he's still more well known in England than he is over here. But he was on a brilliant series called Coupling, which was made by Stephen Moffat, who later went on to be showrunner of Doctor Who. And he is the main character of that. And I knew him from that. And I was like, hey, look who it is. This is the guy. I freaking love him. And I kind of hated that he was such a douche in this movie because I really wanted to like him. He's a very likable guy. But not in this movie. I absolutely hate that character. And then the other big name we got, rounding out is Zoe Saldana.
I had forgotten she was in this movie. She was not famous yet.
Yeah, this was very early in her career as far as things you might have seen her in.
She was a long way away from playing Gamora in Guardians of the Galaxy.
And this was, of course, before she was Uhura as well.
Yeah.
So she had done some things. She had been in Drumline before this, which is probably her biggest thing. She was in that awful Britney Spears movie, Crossroads. But Drumline was probably the biggest thing she was in, and that was still kind of a niche.
Yeah.
It was kind of a niche movie because, like, you know, you have to be kind of a particular type of person to give a crap about the Drumline in a marching band.
This is the only one of these movies that she's in. She doesn't show up in any of the sequels.
Yeah, which is sad because she could, you know, I always liked that character and I never knew who played her, but she made such an impression of me, and I was shocked when I did the rewatch at how little she's actually in the movie. Because I always remembered the awesome female pirate that went along with them and wanted her boat back. You know, I remembered everything about this character, and she's on screen for like 10 minutes tops. She has like,
I just assumed that her star rose and that she was just became too big for doing any of the sequels.
I guess, but
it was only a few years later she did do Star Trek, so that really bolstered her career.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know,
maybe she got a boat off screen and then she just sailed off into the unknown.
I would watch that movie. We will say that the two of us have met one of the people from this film.
Yeah, a few months ago. Seven months ago.
Just before, who was our final hurrah before the world kind of stopped. But. Yeah, this year's MarsCon, we had Lee Ehrenberg, who is Pentel. He's the guy that's always hanging around the...
Hello, Puppet.
Yeah, he's the Hello, Puppet guy, and he's the one always hanging around with the one-eyed pirate with the wooden eye. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they're the comic relief for the film, and they do a good job of it. You know how I usually hate comic relief characters that are shoved into films like this? I actually really like these guys.
It is the trope of the fat guy and the thin guy, but it works in this movie.
Yeah, because they don't ever make fun of him for being fat.
True.
I think that's why it works, is that, like, neither of them are made fun of because of their, you know, it's like, cool. They're not calling the one guy Beanpole or anything, so... Anyway, excellent cast for this film, which I think kind of shocked all of us when the film was being made, because I know I was like, why are all these really good people in such a movie destined to be absolute crap?
I think that had a lot to do with who was producing this movie, Jerry Bruckheimer.
Yeah. That was a thing that shocked me at the time too. I was like, what is Jerry Bruckheimer doing on this? I mean, you know, Jerry Bruckheimer is super well known, you know, Top Gun and The Rock and Armageddon and Black Hawk Down. And, he's the action guy.
Yeah.
Why is he doing a Disney attraction movie that's destined to fail, you know? I cannot tell people who weren't really in the in the fandom at the time how much we hated this movie before it came out.
Yeah.
I mean, you remember that, don't you? I'm not like misremembering that, I don't think, but like every Disney fan I knew was like, this is gonna suck.
And then it had a lot to do with the perception of the Country Bears the previous year.
Yeah, I think we had already heard that they might start doing a Haunted Mansion. I think they announced a slew of films at once, and it was like, we're going to do Country Bears, and we're going to do Pirates, and we're going to do Haunted Mansion. I remember those being announced.
Yeah, and yeah, a lot of people, us included, had to eat crow because it was a hit.
And happily, at first I thought everybody was nuts. They were like, no, it's a really good movie, you should watch it. And I'm like, I don't know what you've been drinking, but I do not want any of that.
It's also, you know, a pirate movie in 2003, and really pirate movies were not really popular.
They had not been popular for like 40 years at that point.
Yeah, and not that other studios hadn't tried. I mean, there was at least in the 80s, at least two adaptations of The Pirates of Penzance.
Oh, well, some of those are very good. The one with Linda Ronstadt is amazing, and I watched it all the time in my childhood. Go look it up. I believe you can buy it on Amazon Prime. Anyway, but as far as like actual, you know, not operettas, there had been that like that one with Gina Davis or something like that.
Yeah, I forgot about that.
I don't even remember what the name of that was. It came out sometime in the 90s, and it was one of the biggest bombs of all time. And everybody was like, yeah, nobody will ever watch a pirate movie again. Pirate movies are super dead.
Yeah.
And then this came out and proved that, no, people like pirates. That was just a bad movie.
Yeah.
I honestly don't think any genre necessarily dies unless it is incredibly specific to a time and place. Like, I'm not sure that most people will ever watch, like, you know, disco films as a genre again, because it's not the 70s anymore. There might be one, but it's not gonna, I don't think, make like a huge comeback.
It's a period
piece, specific.
Like, if it's a period piece with disco as the background, maybe.
Yeah, but I'm not entirely sure that somebody tomorrow is gonna be like, we're gonna make a movie set in 2022 where somebody is a disco dancing fiend and can't, you know, like, we're not gonna see a modern remake of Saturday Night Fever, I don't think.
Mm.
You know? This year is the weirdest, so that may be like a trailer will drop for that tomorrow and prove me wrong. But, you know, unless it's so specific to a time and place, unless you're doing a complete period piece, I don't think most genres ever really die. I think they're just bad movies.
Mm.
Like, I don't think superhero, like, comic book movies were ever a bad idea. I just think a lot of them were badly made. Mm. Things like that. You know, you always hear, like, this genre is, you know, people don't want that, and they will never want that again. I don't think that's true. I think people will want a film as long as it's good, no matter the genre. They said the same thing about Lord of the Rings. Like, fantasy is dead. Why are you making a 17-hour Lord of the Rings trilogy?
Yeah.
But it worked, and it's great. But, okay, so back to this specific film. This has a super effective opening scene.
Yeah.
Just the image of the little girl singing Pirate's Life for Me in the fog. And then they come across the ship in the water that's on fire, and everybody's dead except for Will. And we get the glimpse of the Black Pearl, you know, running by in the fog. And immediately I was like, okay, that first scene alone was worth the price of the movie.
Yeah. And Yeah, and amazingly, you know, Elizabeth kind of just swipes the medallion right off Will's neck there. And it's understandable why she does it, because she sees skulls as the symbol of pirates. He's wearing a pirate medallion, so therefore, since being a pirate is illegal, even though he is a child, he could just be hung for it.
Yeah, if you don't know anything about the time, they would hang children frequently.
That actually happened in one of the later movies.
it does, and I'm kind of... I don't want to say glad, but I appreciate that they mentioned that. The kind of official capitalist class that was running things at the time, backed especially heavily by the British Navy, were ruthless, and I'm not necessarily... Genocidal is not the right word, since it's not like an ethnic or religious group to be a pirate, but they were determined to eradicate piracy. And while, you know, let's get into pirate apologetics, I guess, but while there were absolutely horrible, murderous, torturous pirates, that is a thing. Mm-hmm. And a large part, I'm not, you know, it did attract that kind. A lot of the people that got stuck with piracy were just kind of people trying to make a living that couldn't do so on the right side of the law, quote unquote. So there were women who didn't want to be somebody's wife that became pirates, because that's a much more self-actualized life than what you get in most civilizations at the time. You had people that just, you know, we need to make a little extra money, and we mostly run an honest merchant ship, but this time we took on some rum to, you know, make a little extra money because we need it to feed our families, kind of thing. And like I said, they would not... It didn't matter how you ended up on a pirate ship, even if you were a child, maybe an orphan with nowhere else to go and nothing else to do, and ended up on a pirate ship, which happened a lot. You still got killed if you got captured. So, I kind of love that Elizabeth is just like, he is my age.
Yeah.
And pirate or not, I'm not going to let them murder him for that. I don't know what he did.
Mm-hmm. Especially when, like, 2 seconds earlier, her father says, take care of him.
That too. Yeah. But, you know, just about a minute before that, she hears Norrington talking about how he wants to murder every single pirate on the planet. So, you know. Not fun. Can we talk just for a second about how creepy it is that Norrington wants to marry Elizabeth? I know this was normal at the time, or normalized by society, but it's still freaking creepy. I'm okay with adults over a certain age having, like, age differences. I think once both parties are over about 25, I really don't think there's any more, like, maturing or growing that you do as far as neurologically speaking. Mm-hmm. You're pretty much a full-fledged adult by that point. So above the age of 25, I kind of, like, a 25-year-old wants to marry a 60-year-old, I honestly don't have much problem with it. But it seems a little weirder when Elizabeth has to be, it's said 8 years difference, and she looks to be about 12. 13 maybe, so she's like 20, 21 tops, which is an adult, fortunately, you know, by that point, but, like, he has known her since she was 12.
Yeah.
Does that not seem weird to anybody else? Again, I know this was the norm at the time, I don't care.
Yeah, it is a bit of the creep factor. I didn't put it together. I thought it was like that was his son or something, just because I try to not have the creep factor in there. But yeah, it's the same character. Same guy.
I had forgotten it was the same character, but yeah, it's the same guy, which, you know, no.
Yeah, and he was what? I mean, let's say, even if he was 20 or 30, he would be 30 or 40 at this point, marrying a 20-year-old, which, again, like you said, it's not wrong if there are two willing parties, but again, he's known her since she was a child.
Yeah, I think it's different if you first met them as an adult.
Yeah.
I think if you meet your partner, no matter the age difference, when you are both adults.
If a 40-year-old man met a 20-year-old and they fall in love, fine. You know, you can debate the age difference another day, but they're both full grown adults, can make their own decisions. But now you have someone who's met his future wife when she was 12, 13.
And has lived very closely next to her. They have known him. They have been in Port Royal and watched him, you know, rise through the ranks. Her father is the governor. You know, he would have been over at their house all the time. You know, when did your attraction to this child start, Mr. Norrington? Anyway, I don't want to think bad things about Jack Davenport. He's a lovely man, as far as I can tell. Like, this character is just skeevy to me. I'm glad he kind of gets, like, redemption later in the series a little bit. But in this film, he's really skeevy.
Because you're not supposed to root for him. You're supposed to root for Will.
Well, yeah, but there's a different... They try to make it at the end of the movie where, like, he's just doing his job, which is, you know, cop apologetics through the ages. But, yeah, no, I don't like him even at the end of the movie. I mean, I'm glad he doesn't scream, like, the girl is mine! She is my property! She has been betrothed to me! And then, like, you know, run off with him or something. But, at least there's that. At least they kind of wrap that up by him, like, giving his blessing, which, okay, there's hope for the man, but, you know, still. I hate this character. He just makes my skin crawl.
And then there's the corset that Elizabeth has to wear, which becomes a running gag through this movie.
I hate this joke. Because it makes it seem like the corset was invented in the 1700s and Elizabeth has never seen one before. She is wearing a corseted dress at the beginning of that film at 12, which would have been normal for a girl of that age of her class. Corsets had been the staple of female fashion for like 300, 400 years easily at this point. So, no. This is a woman who would have been wearing corsets like this her entire life, basically. Also, if... Yes, there are stories of, like, women fainting because of corsets. And that can happen. I'm not saying it doesn't and never has. But if that happens, you are wearing the corset incorrectly. A corset correctly worn should not be uncomfortable. So if your corset is uncomfortable, please take it off and, you know, redo it correctly with somebody who knows what they're doing. So, yeah, I hate this. The one thing that they do get right, though, about the whole, like, corset swooning, falling into the ocean thing is when Jack removes the outer layers of her clothing. Mm-hmm. The overdresses and the petticoats and all that other nonsense, because there were actually lots of reports of women who ended up falling into water dying specifically because their outfit was too heavy. Mm. It's throughout this period of history and even before, because women, especially for, you know, kind of the upper noble, you know, higher class women, she would have been wearing so many layers of clothing. In fact, I'm kind of impressed that Jack could cut it off of her underwater that easily.
You think that's the first time he's ever cut a dress off a woman?
Underwater, maybe. But still, bravo to him, because that actually did cause the death of many women, was falling into water and not being able, even if you could swim, the dress would weigh you down.
And then it comes back later. Oh, you think you're tough? Try wearing a corset. Which was funny enough for them to put it in the trailer.
Yeah, except it also wasn't true, because men's corsetry has been a thing throughout history as well.
Not so much for pirates, though.
Well, not for pirates necessarily, but
noblemen, yes.
It's a thing. I mean, the idea of a man wearing a corset is not like crazy. It's been fashioned throughout various points in history. The interesting thing is that most of the men in this movie do wear the tight fitted waistcoat vests. Especially Orlando Bloom does in his costume. He has that very tight-fitted vest, which is kind of what men's fashion evolved into at certain points. But those things are still very snug if you've ever tried to wear one. Like if they are done correctly, they will suck you in a little bit, you know, around the waistline. They just didn't have the whaleboning stays in there like a woman's corset did for the extra support. Weird pirate fashion.
Elizabeth puts the medallion on before she even meets Norrington, because she apparently had a nightmare of the day she met Will.
Honestly, I didn't think that she was wearing it specifically because of that. I've always just kind of kind of thought she wore it every day. Like, that was just her thing. She just wore that underneath her clothing every single day. And people just assumed she was wearing, like, a cross or something, like other people might.
Yeah, so, and when she falls in, that signals the pirates, because the pirates want the treasure.
I like that it was a visible enough signal that the idiot sailors on the Navy guys in the dinghy there were like, what was that? Because it sends out like this massive shockwave. Interestingly enough, only when it touches seawater, I guess.
Yeah, so if she was bathing with it, it wouldn't affect. Maybe it has to do with salt. It's also magic, so we don't really have to explain it.
Yeah. No, I want my magic explained, thank you. I love everything about the opening of this. The thing we kind of skipped over, though, is Jack's entry to town, which is the greatest. I love the way his character is introduced. That he's on this, like, pathetic little sailboat that is quickly sinking as he and he finally comes into port at the crow's nest on the mast.
Yeah, because it's sinking.
And then it sinks just enough that, like, when it gets to the dock, he can just step off with no trouble. And then I love the guy, like, no, you charging have to pay to tie up your ship. And he's like, what ship?
you got to pay ship? To park here. 1 shilling to mount your boat. Here's 3 shillings, and you never saw me. Hello, Mr. Smith, enjoy your stay. Which I did get a laugh out of.
The little slave boy that was next to the dock attendant guy.
Yeah.
I love the way that little kid reacts to everything, because you know that boy is like, man, must be nice to be a white guy that can just steal money from people and not have anybody say anything about it. Mm-hmm. Because that little kid gives the greatest reaction to, how about I give you 3 shillings and you just shut up and like, yeah, oh yeah, yes, sir, absolutely. I'm just going to pocket this money. That little boy gives him a look like, uh-huh, you dirty thief. So I love that kid. I don't know if he went on to be an actor in other things, but that, from a child actor of that age, that was such an excellent series of reactions.
Yeah, and Jack apparently is the only one who knows how to swim. Apparently you can be in the Navy, the British Navy, and not know how to swim.
That was very common. They did not really care if you knew how to swim. It was a plus. But at this point in time, the British Navy just needed bodies. Mm-hmm. Were you willing to sign up on a boat and go shoot cannons at pirates? Okay, we'll take you. Like, there was like almost no barrier to entry for the British Navy at the time, from my reading of the time period. But I really love the way they set up all the characters in so few. You know, we immediately know that Will has become an expert blacksmith, even though he's still just an apprentice.
Yeah.
You know, the sword he presents is just so gorgeous. Oh. That's my happy place, is him balancing the sword perfectly on his finger. Oh, so good. as somebody with a sword collection in their house, that just makes me happy. But I absolutely adore that they use so few things. You know that he is so much lower on the class system than she is, because of his refusal to use her name and her father's little smug thing about, well, at least he knows his place, you know.
Even when she insists on it, you know, we've known each other since we were kids. You can call me Elizabeth.
Yeah, I literally saved your life, dude. You can call me Elizabeth. It's okay. But he is very aware of what his place is and is not. I mean, he's still an apprentice. Mm-hmm. He is of the age that he should have his own shop, and technically he kind of does, because the actual blacksmith in town is a drunken fool, and apparently Will is the only one that doesn't work in that shop, him and the donkey. But you know, he should be kind of setting out and making his own way, and still he's an apprentice, you know.
And that has a lot, you know, they said the class system. He's like, not, you can only have one blacksmith in town, and that's the one blacksmith.
Yeah,
in
what's
town.
He going to do? Open a competing smithy across town or something? You know, I don't know. It's very obvious he hasn't really left the island because of Elizabeth.
Yeah.
I mean, they don't really say it in the movie, but it's kind of obvious that's. You know, why would you stay in that crap job when you could literally just, you know, save up a few coins, get on a ship, and go anywhere else in the world?
You know, and it's made, you know, known pretty early in the movie that he's straight up in love with Elizabeth, but because of their classes, he believes it's never going to happen.
Well, and we know very early in the film, I mean, that first scene where she's like, please call me Elizabeth, we know that she's in love with him and he's in love with her.
Yeah.
I mean, it's super duper obvious to anybody other than her father, because even her maids are like, we know that you really want to marry Will.
Yeah, there's after she gets rescued, one of the maidens like, oh yes, you know, Norrington, you'll be very lucky to have a man like that, but that Will Turner's pretty hot. Yeah, yeah, you mind your place.
Yeah. I mean, both of them are pretty hot, but, like, you know, given their professions, I'd rather go with the honest blacksmith than the skeevy, you know, British naval guy. Especially at that time, you know, it wouldn't be so bad, but the British Navy in the 1700s, are you kidding me? I love how the humor works in this. I think that's the movie's strongest point. And for some reason, with Johnny Depp's kind of weird off-the-wall performance, the humor works better, because he is so over the top in his manner that anything he says suddenly becomes less cheesy and weird.
Yeah, and Depp really wasn't known as a comic actor at the time. I mean, he had done fantasy movies like Edward Scissorhands and the like, but he really wasn't known for his comedy.
I honestly, when I saw this, people were like, this is such a departure for Johnny Depp. And I'm like, some of y'all people need Benny and June in your life, because, yeah. I love Benny and June. And Benny is just like modern day Jack Sparrow that's a little more reserved. But Benny in that movie Benny is the brother, the character Johnny Depp plays, whose name I can't remember, but his character in Benny and June is another kind of eccentric weirdo in a very similar style. It's just that dialed up to 11 in this.
And he would,
with a weird wig and a Keith Richards.
Was this before or after Charlie and the Chocolate Factory?
Oh, well before.
Okay.
This would have been the mid-90s. Mid-90s. But it's the movie that gave us I Would Walk 500 Miles by the Proclaimers.
Mm.
That's why anybody in America knows that song. Because of that movie. Yeah. And that's a good thing, because I freaking love the Proclaimers. But, yeah, if you had actually watched Johnny Depp's career, which I strangely had, I was kind of a big fan of his in the 90s. And I had watched a lot of his earlier work as his career developed into him being a huge box office star. And so when I saw this, I was like, no, that's just kind of, I don't really know why he made those choices, but I respect them as acting choices. And it does seem like the sort of thing Johnny Depp would do, because he is kind of that guy. But apparently a lot of people were really shocked by his portrayal. I like that apparently, I like that apparently the Disney executives asked Johnny Depp, is he drunk or is he gay? And I wanted to be like, both? A little bit of column A, a little bit of column B? That makes the character better. Why would you be really that, you know, a drunken pirate is kind of the stereotype. Also, a lot of pirates were gay. Remember how we talked about the freedom to be yourself? They performed gay weddings on pirate ships. Not a joke. Historical fact. There were gay weddings on pirate ships. There were people living openly as gay men or lesbians or sometimes transgender people. There was a lot of freedom in the open sea that led people to become pirates other than I want to be a criminal. And I kind of respect Johnny Depp for being like, yeah, he's the sort of weirdo that this is the kind of life that would have attracted him. And there's things in the movie about like, oh, did he go crazy on the island he was marooned on? And they were like, well, maybe, maybe not. But the thing is, we find out he was only there for 3 days.
Yeah.
And he was enjoying himself.
Because he had booze.
Because he had booze and food and, you know, an entire stash of stuff left by a group of rum runners. But so Jack Sparrow has just always been like that, which is really interesting, because yeah, that's exactly the type of guy who would be a pirate, you know, the black woman, you know. He's like Zoe Saldana shows up and it's like, yep, that's exactly the type of person who would be a pirate. That's, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of like that he made these choices. And he said the reason he did the Keith Richards thing was because he read up on pirates extensively. And he realized they were kind of the rock stars of the time. And they were. Yeah. You know how Elizabeth is constantly in the movie? Like, she is the most genre-savvy person in the movie. You know, like, I want to parlay due to the code set down by this and that. And then we find out later she has read everything about Jack Sparrow.
She's a straight up fangirl.
She is an absolute fangirl. And here's the thing. That was pretty close to reality. That pirate tales, these people were, yeah, they were wanted criminals, but, you know, if they showed up in your port, you were probably maybe going to buy them a drink and hope you could go home with a story about how you hung out with insert famous pirate of the day here. You know? Now, granted, if you were unsympathetic and greedy, yeah, you might turn them into the local authorities for money, but then everyone in town would hate you because you were the person that just killed the really cool famous pirate guy everybody had been reading about. You know, it wasn't just
buzzkill.
Yeah, it wasn't just the loss of a pirate in some situations, but it was kind of also the loss of like a media franchise. Like, well, if they got caught and killed, there's going to be no more stories about their exploits. And people, you know, if you're starved for entertainment, that's what you want. So it's not as cut and dry as we think of it today. There was so much nuance in this, as there is in almost everything in life. But Johnny Depp read up on the history of pirates and realized, like, this guy avoids capture by being the famous guy everybody wants to have a drink with.
And, you know, he's at least he's even known in Port Royal. But granted, it's by the tattoo on his arm, but they know who Jack Sparrow is. And he even has this big, you know, today was the day you almost caught the legendary Jack Sparrow.
Yeah, but the thing is, when you know a little bit more, and I am not an expert on pirates, although I do like them and I have read, you know, books over the years about the historical, you know, pirates and stuff. But if you know even just a little bit about pirates at this point in time, that's how you're a successful pirate. Most pirates lived on their reputation. If you board a ship and you're like, hi, I'm Captain Jack Sparrow, and you know by my reputation that I cut off people's hands, but if you're really nice to me, I don't. Well, then you don't have to go through the nonsense of actually cutting off people's hands. They're scared of you. They'll give you whatever you want. You'll leave, and then they'll get to go home with the story of how I almost lost a hand to Captain Jack Sparrow or whatever.
Yeah.
And so that's why Jack is always blustering through these things, because a pirate's reputation was everything. It's how you kind of got through your life by bluster. It's one of the reasons for like the kind of skull and crossbone motif and everything. You wanted people scared so that you didn't have to actually like murder people in a lot of cases. It just made it easier, you know, like you wanted people to surrender rather than put up a fight so that they could go home and have the cool story of their encounter with pirates rather than being the person whose ship was sunk by pirates, you know? Mm. But I love all these choices, and I can't imagine watching any cut of this film and going like, why is he Keith Richards? You know, like, yeah.
And the fact that they eventually got Keith Richards to play his father in the later movies.
Absolutely. So good. The weird thing is apparently the reason Jeffrey Rush, you know, we're just getting to the point where Barbossa comes in, but the reason that Jeffrey Rush is in this movie apparently was because they wanted somebody that would just play straight up villain and not give it any nuance. And I'm like, Jeffrey Rush is a really amazingly talented actor who gives nuance in every one of his performances. Why would you think he'd be the stereotypical bad guy? Because he's kind of not in this either. Like, you really do feel bad for Barbossa in some ways when he talks about the curse.
Yeah, drink has no satisfaction. He can't eat anything. He can't even enjoy being with a woman romantically. Nothing that a normal person would consider pleasure has anything to him because of the curse of greed.
Well, he doesn't even say necessarily the pleasure, because the lines right after that is, for all these years, I have been starving to death and unable to eat. So thirsty and not able to, like, it does seem that this crew is in pain. Because otherwise, like, you're immortal, just don't go out in the moonlight. It's like a reverse vampire or something. Like, just don't let anybody see skeleton you, and you're immortal. Like,
Yeah, you're immortal, that and that's chest. Great. But then again, that's the downside, is that you will never, you know, you can eat anything you want, but you'll never taste it, and you'll never get full. You'll never get anything.
Given the way my life is, if it was like, well, food and drink won't really taste good to you anymore, but you will have a life free of pain and sickness, and you will live forever, I'd be like, okay, fair trade. You know, like, dessert is tasty, but it's not, like, worth a lifetime, like, a short life of suffering for. You know? Like, but the fact that they add, like, I am hungry all the time, and also I can't get any pleasure or sustenance from food. It's that I feel the horrific need and pain from the absence of this thing that, to me, would be the curse. That, to me, I'm like, ooh, I understand that. I understand pain that you can't make go away.
Yeah, his all of it coming down to an obsession over apples. Like, all he wants to do is be able to eat an apple.
Which I find interesting that it is a vitamin C source that he's craving. Because we always think of pirates and scurvy. And scurvy is really hard to get. Just eat a fruit or vegetable at any point during the year and you're kind of okay. Mm-hmm. Like, you have to go a pretty long time with absolutely zero fresh fruit or vegetables to get scurvy, which is why it's a thing we think of with sailors and pirates. Because if you're on the ocean for that long, you can't keep fresh fruit and vegetables. You have to basically survive off of, like, hardtack and liquor, which is what they did. So you don't really get any vitamin C if you're out on the ocean for long periods of time. And if you can't put into port because you're afraid of, you know, being arrested and killed, then you just keep sailing and sailing and sailing. So I find it fascinating that he's obsessed with fresh fruit. He wants the taste of fresh fruit again, because that would have been a rarity for a pirate to begin with, but also a necessity for survival, which is fascinating to me.
And the fact that that is, like, the first thing you see in him doing in the sequels.
Yeah. This movie is deep, y'all.
Because when I saw Barbossa show up in the sequel, and the first thing he does is eat an apple, I'm going, yes!
Yeah, you really wanted him to get that apple. And of course, they kind of went, I love that they didn't want him to have any nuance to him in this movie. They just wanted him to be a straight-up bad guy. You know, he is the absolute villain. There's no nuance. There's no feeling for him. And everybody was like, we really like him. Bring him back.
Yeah.
I really want him to have a good life after the curse.
And he actually has his own little story arc. Imagine that, Barbossa, the villain from the first movie, having a story arc where he actually becomes...
I kind of like that almost everybody in this has a story arc in future... Except for Zoe Saldana. Why point her back?
Well, they are making a new one, and they are looking for a female pirate. Granted, the rumor is Margot Robbie, but Disney has the money to, and they already have Zoe Saldana as one of their characters. Why not bring that character back for the new movies?
I would much prefer that. I like Margot Robbie, don't get me wrong, but I would prefer Zoe Saldana's character to do it. I don't know. I really like it. Anyway, I think it's interesting that everybody knows what a great pirate Elizabeth is going to make pretty early on in this.
Mm-hmm.
It is heavily foreshadowed that she's going to become a pirate queen eventually, you know?
Yeah. Again, sequels.
Because she is, first of all, the fangirl that has read everything on pirates. And that helps. You know, it doesn't make you a good pirate, of course, but it helps. And then the thing is that I like that when she actually gets on the ocean, she didn't just read the stories about the pirates. She seems to have read about sailing as well.
Mm-hmm.
We have no proof that she's been on a ship since she came to Port Royal. And it seems unlikely she would have been. Because of her station and her class and stuff like that, she would have just kind of been in the island, I think. But she immediately understands things like, you know, well, if we drop the anchor on this side, it'll cause the ship to swing wildly to that end. We can fire on them. It'll, you know, she's read like unconventional naval military tactics too, apparently.
And it's also a chance, again, having known Norrington all her life, she probably could have picked something up from him.
Well, yeah, there is a certain amount you can pick up just by knowing sailors and naval people and stuff like that. But it is fascinating to me how deep she went into this. And you can obviously tell that she read a lot.
Mm-hmm.
In order to gain this knowledge. I like the fact that, you know, Will Turner in his first meeting with Jack is such an excellent swordsman.
Mm-hmm.
And Jack's like, how did you learn all this? And he's like, well, I spend all day forging swords and then I spend all night practicing fighting with swords, you know, like.
Well, he has to make sure that the swords are enough to withstand battle, so he practices with them.
But we get the idea in the film. I love how much this film doesn't say, but actually just hints at. He says, "I practice so that when I meet a pirate, I can kill him." He was attacked by pirates at the age of 12 and almost died.
Mm-hmm.
His father, he thought, was a merchant sailor who was attacked by pirates and killed. Okay, this poor kid has lost his entire family and almost his life to pirates, and he lives in the capital of we're gonna kill Pirateville, you know? Like, so it makes sense that he is telling the truth in that situation. He has the idea that one day I'm going to get revenge on maybe not the pirates that murdered my father, maybe not the pirates that attacked me personally, but just on pirates in general. Which I find fascinating. I love all the ways in which every character in this movie is somehow competent in ways you don't expect. Will ends up being excellent in battle. You know, he's the guy that you want on your side in battle. Elizabeth is the tactical kind of genius. You know, she's the diplomat and tactician you want. And even though you kind of could say that a lot of Jack's fortune is just that, like it's just luck, there really does seem to be the method behind the madness.
There's a competence there in being a ship's captain.
Yeah, and before the mutiny of Barbossa, you get the feeling that he was a rather skilled pirate. We see him at basically the lowest point in his life. But the list of crimes they're reading out at the end of the film before hanging him is extensive, but also rather impressive. Some of them are comedic, you know, like impersonating a clergyman and things like that. But a lot of them are like, they were interesting enough for Elizabeth to have read the entire Jack Sparrow canon, you know?
Like, yeah.
So, I don't know. I find it interesting at how this entire film is filled with characters that you would really expect to write off. When you first meet Elizabeth, you're like, oh, great, damsel in distress. They kidnap her, some man is going to have to go rescue her, and boy, is that not where the movie goes with that.
No.
You know, and then it's like, oh, well, Will Turner, he's going to be the swashbuckling Errol Flynn kind of whatever. And that's not where they go with him either. And then you're like, oh, Jack Sparrow, he's going to be the goofy guy who just bumbles into everything, and like, they sort of do that, but then you discover that, like, he's actually pretty smart. You know, he goes and he pretends like he's going to steal the Dauntless, and then he steals the Interceptor.
Yeah.
Because he understands the way the military mind would work and, like, oh, he's going to steal our most powerful ship. He doesn't need a powerful ship. He needs a fast ship. So, of course, that's going to be the one he's going to take to catch up to one of the fastest ships. They've already mentioned the speed of the Black Pearl.
And they already mentioned that the Interceptor is the fastest ship in the fleet.
Yeah. So, why would he be taking the Dauntless, which is such a large ship, there's no way that you can run it with a small crew? Mm-hmm. You know, which they even say in the movie, like, you can't sail this with just two men. Well, of course you can't. And he'd be an idiot to try, but everybody thinks he's an idiot because of the way he acts. But I like that he's, you know, he's funny and he doesn't take himself too seriously, but he's not incompetent at his job. Mm. Which I find really interesting.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about Gibbs. Because we see Gibbs earlier in the movie as a member of the Royal Navy, and when we see him again, he's on Tortuga as a pirate. We're never given a reason, he's just a pirate now. And he knows Jack.
Yeah, and it's kind of interesting because he doesn't seem to know Elizabeth.
Yeah. But then again, it's probably the last time he saw Elizabeth was she was a child.
Yeah, but as they discover the story of, you know, this is Bootstrap Bill's son. This is, you know, this is the last time he was saw. He had the medallion. You know, I know he didn't remember, like, that kid had the medallion. But wouldn't you at some point go, wait a minute. We ran into the Black Pearl once before about 8 years ago. And we, you know, saved Will Turner from, you know, a pirate attack, and, you know. Mm-hmm. And Gibbs is even the one that points out that the ship Will was on probably didn't have a magazine explosion. It was probably destroyed by pirates. Mm. So I think Gibbs knows more than he's saying throughout the entire movie. So, yeah, I don't, I'm not really sure that Gibbs is necessarily a pirate, but he is in Tortuga.
Yeah.
It seems like he's just a drunk rather than a pirate, but I don't know.
Well, he was seen with a little flask drinking it on the ship, so it's probably he got exiled from the Navy for essentially drinking on the job.
It's one theory, honestly. But I really love this character throughout the series. He's really well acted, and he's, you know, got a good little story arc.
Mm-hmm.
You can talk about how the quality of the later films degraded, and I'll agree with that, but I do like that they stayed committed to continuing the story of the characters we started with.
Yeah.
Even some of the really minor characters.
Yeah, even after we finish Will and Elizabeth's story, continuing with Jack's story, we get a little bit more with Gibbs. Again, we get a little bit more with Barbossa. It's just,
yeah, and we get more with Norrington, and we get more with Governor Swan.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I really like that.
Mm-hmm. That whole scene with Gibbs, just go back to him. It's like, the funny thing is that, you know, Will slaps him with another bucket of water. Like, I'm already awake. Yeah, but you smell. And it's like, he takes that beat and goes, well, yeah, like, he was just sleeping in a pigsty. So yeah, he deserved that.
Yeah.
I just thought it was funny.
It is. I love, like I said, I just love the humor in this. And I think if you didn't have something as over the top as Jack Sparrow to balance it, I'm not sure the comedy plays as well. I think some of the things like, yes, but you have heard of me, you know, doesn't play, it plays cheesy if the rest of the movie is played kind of straight.
If it was any other actor, they probably would not have had that delivery Johnny Depp had.
Yeah, and there's a lot of lines like that where I kind of thought on the rewatch where I was like, if it wasn't for the context that it's in, this line just kind of dropped in any other movie would be considered horribly ridiculous. You know? And instead, you know, his delivery of like, but why is the rum gone? You know? I'm not sure that's a meme in any other movie.
Yeah, if
Matthew McConaughey did that
line,
viral.
Or even Hugh Jackman doing that line, it probably would not have had the long-lasting effect it has.
Yeah. Also, bravo to Elizabeth for being able to drink that much rum and still wake up at dawn to build a signal fire.
I do like that she makes it, like, even though she is clearly drunk, she says, it's going to take a lot more rum for me to hook up with you.
Well, yeah, that's true. I love Johnny Depp, but I'm not sure I would be hooking up with Jack Sparrow, you know, like, because that just seems like a poor life choice. But I don't know. There's so much, like, every single scene in this movie is really kind of gorgeous. And even though I think it goes on a little too long, the action scenes are amazing. This contains one of the greatest sword fights I think I've ever seen in film.
Oh yeah, the choreography, the action choreography, the swordsmanship in this movie is amazing. The sword fight between Will and Jack, and the one later on between Jack and Barbossa. It's amazing.
I think that for simple sword fight choreography, I think that the scene between Will and Jack when they first have their duel in Port Royal, I think that that one is one of the greatest of all time.
I have to give the credit to the second fight, the one between Jack and Barbossa, in the fact that they're both going in and out of the moonlight, and the effects just are almost seamless as they both turn from human to skeleton.
But to me, that is more a feat of special effects than it is of swordplay.
True.
The choreography is good in that one, but it's not as intricate because they then have to match it with the special effects. So while I think visually stunning and an absolute triumph of visual effects, I'm not sure that it really counts as one of the greatest sword fights on film. Whereas I think that the intricacy of the earlier fight is much more an outstanding sense of what the stunt crew and the fight coordinators and stuff can do in that scene. You know, them balancing on the wagon, and then, you know, one of Jack's arms is pinned to the ceiling while he's balancing on the wagon and still trying to fight. And, you know, there's some moves in there that are just stunning. Also, I feel really bad for the donkey in that scene.
Yeah, I was going to mention that. Poor donkey. You mentioned the donkey, like, just gets a hot skewer with a sun don't shine thanks to Jack.
Yeah. Jack, don't be, you know, hurting animals. I get you were desperate, but come on.
Although credit to Will for doing a sword fight with the same hot poker.
Yeah, and that poor donkey's reaction of like, nope, nope, you're not doing that again. I'm walking.
Whole lot of nope right there.
It's hard for me to gather my thoughts about this movie because I love it so much. I want to talk about every single thing in this film for hours. You know, take any scene and I could have probably done a podcast on that one scene. So it's difficult for me to try to pull it together to make it coherent for the whole movie in a relatively short-ish amount of time.
I gotta go we talked about the corset running gag, but I do love the slap running gag where, you know, he's in Tortuga, he gets slapped by two women. I didn't deserve that. I might have deserved that. And then he meets up with Zoe Saldana. Did you deserve that? That one I did.
Yeah, I stole her ship. That's worthy of a slap, if nothing else.
At least a slap.
That to me is a great running gag. There's so many in this film, and then they continue throughout the series. You know, a lot of these gags are running gags that continue through multiple films.
And I think it's in the sequel where the slap starts happening to Will, where he gets mentioned Jack's name.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Since we mentioned the donkey, let's talk about our other star animal.
Oh, the other Jack. The other Jack.
The other Jack. Jack the monkey. I love this monkey so much.
Disney has a long history of monkeys.
Yeah. I like monkeys and Disney. So, you know, Disney monkeys I also like. But This one, I mean, what is that, a capuchin or whatever? They're adorable anyway. But the way they kind of film it, the way they use the monkey for humor, you know, they have, like, the monkey reacting to things as, like, you know, punchlines of, like, what the other people are doing.
Yeah, there's I think my favorite one is, like, the monkey is, I forget what the monkey's doing, and then he turns around and he sees Elizabeth. And is just scared out of his mind.
Yeah, right before she hurls him out the window.
Yeah.
It's when we see that the monkey is also under the curse.
Yeah.
So I love that once she realizes that it's basically an immortal monkey, she's okay just yeeting him out a window. Like It's like the idea of that they named the monkey Jack as another just stab at Jack's reputation, yeah. You know.
We hear there's someone named Jack in the Black Pearl. The only Jack here be the monkey.
Yeah. The interesting thing is let's just go ahead and talk about it since we're talking about the monkey. They do show at the, you know, during the big epic fight scene where they're all skeletons towards the end of the movie, they do show that the monkey is under the curse. Mm-hmm. And then they break the curse for the entire crew. Presumably this means the monkey as well. I guess they made the monkey do a blood sacrifice to the Aztec gods. I don't know. But then we see we have a post-credits scene.
Yeah, it's not just for Marvel movies.
Yeah, and this was prior to the time that Marvel was doing that.
Yeah, the Iron Man was 2018. Is this 2003?
Yeah. So this was several years before we get Iron Man and the idea of the post-credit, you know, Marvel thing. But the thing is that Disney's been doing kind of weird post-credit stingers for a while in some of their films. Not all of them.
Most of the animated films. We talked before
about Aladdin having one and stuff like that. But it's not that
they were gags. They were not part of the story.
But this one was.
Mm-hmm.
This one is very definitely sequel bait. In which we see the supposedly dead body of Barbossa lying in the treasure room in the cave. And then we see Jack the monkey come in, skitter up and take a coin back from the chest, at which point the moonlight hits him and he turns into the skeletal monkey, and then the whole thing ends on a jump scare as he screeches and the camera zooms into his mouth,
and it's done very slowly, like you could his flesh slowly decays off his body.
Yeah, so we see that because this is not how Moonlight reacted to the other cursed people or to the monkey when we see it under the curse before. So it's kind of obvious that this is a new curse.
Hmm.
And that this is the first time that the Moonlight is kind of stripping the image of the flesh. So it is my thing that they cared enough for the monkey to remove the curse from the monkey, and then the monkey was like, screw that, I was immortal. I'm going back and getting me some of that immortality. Which I respect. Like, mad respect to the monkey for just being like, no, I can deal with it. I can deal with it. I'm a tough monkey. But he is so adorable throughout. Even kind of when he's in his skeletal form, he's still kind of adorable. But I find it interesting that that's the image they chose to end the movie on. And the weird thing is that I wonder how many people saw this at first.
Yeah. Again, post-credit scenes were not the norm in these blockbuster movies as they are now. So again, that's with the Marvel movies. So once the credits roll, people are just leaving the theater. So
even after it was known in the Marvel films, I would still witness about half the theater leave. Only about half the people stayed to see any mid-credit or post-credit sequence.
But most of them is coming, well, I'll just go on YouTube and when I get to the car and watch it.
Yeah. This was before YouTube.
Yeah.
At least if I don't think YouTube started until 2005, I think.
Somewhere around there.
But yeah, even if it was, it wasn't like you could just easily find this stuff on YouTube. You know, it was still difficult to Google video.
Yeah, you couldn't really. You're going relying on someone's posting it on their MySpace page.
Yeah, that someone has a page that has enough video hosting and streaming bandwidth to be able to host that, you know.
Oh, but, they would have to read someone's review. Oh, at the end of the movie, there's a scene where this happens.
Yeah, this was before Twitter as well.
Mm-hmm.
Before Facebook. Before Facebook. You basically had to have, like, a friend who worked in the movie theater that was like, oh, by the way, there's a thing at the end. I noticed it when I was sweeping the theater the other day. Or you're a weirdo like me because I have stayed to the ending credits of every movie I have ever seen. The first time I watch a movie, I let the credits play through in its entirety, even if I'm watching it at home.
Which, it's kind of difficult on Disney Plus because as soon as the credits start, it kind of zooms small. Same for like Netflix and stuff like that.
Please add a setting that says, no, you a-holes, I want to watch the credits. The credits are part of the movie. For years, I talked about this in the Iron Man one. For years, I'd have people helpfully tell me, there's nothing at the end of this one. And I'm like, yeah, there's credits. I'm watching the credits. The credits are interesting to me. Go away and let me watch the movie I paid for. I've actually gotten a theater to refund my ticket because the projector shut off before the credits were over.
Hmm.
That's how much I... That's how... I went totally Karen on a theater one time because they cut the movie off as soon as the credits started playing because they were ready to go home. And I made the manager give me a ticket to come watch the movie again sometime. Mm. Credits are part of the movie. These people all worked on the thing you like. Give them, 4 minutes of your time or whatever it takes credits to run these days.
Especially over the last 6 months where none of these people are working.
Yeah, please remember that the people that you love that do all this stuff, they are really hurting right now. You know, that's why I eventually decided, I mean, yes, it was a gift, but I could have been like, no, I want to spend the money on something else. It's one of the reasons why I eventually decided to throw the extra money at Mulan, because I'm like, man, you know. I want them to understand that, like, I really want this stuff back as soon as it is my fear that studios are going to be like, oh, we learned workarounds during the pandemic. We can cut a lot of crew and, you know, stuff out of that. Like, no, I want big flashy things where you have to employ 7,000 people to make it because I want those people to have jobs. So... yeah, big flashy things that employ 7,000 people, please. Thank you.
Yeah.
But we've hopped all around this movie, but let's kind of bring it together. There's not a lot we can really say about the plot. Almost everybody has seen this movie.
Yeah.
You know, if you haven't, go watch it. Go watch it. Why did you even listen to us talk about it?
This almost 20-year-old movie.
Yeah. Oh my God. Stop saying things like that. It just makes me feel so old. Okay. But I absolutely loved this rewatch. And honestly, it's one of the reasons when we talked about doing a Pirate Month, this was two of the films we debated over, and two of the films were like, nope, we must talk about this. And this is one of the definite.
You can't do a pirate themed month in modern era without, you have to talk about one of the Pirates of the Caribbean movies.
Yeah.
So let's talk, we talk about the first one, and this movie still holds up amazingly. It's a bit longer than I remember it being.
That is maybe my only quibble with this movie is that
this is a 2.5 hour movie.
Yeah. I like the movie, but, and I love the action. It is an action movie, but a couple of those sequences, you could have maybe taken 2 or 3 minutes out of them.
Yeah.
And it would have still been a really good action scene and accomplished all the things it needed to accomplish. I liked everything, but there are a few of the action set pieces that I were like, I wish you had edited this a bit more tightly. I'm not sure this needed to be 2.5 hours as a film.
So let's quickly go over a few more things. One being that song. When you say Pirates of the Caribbean, you know that song. He's a pirate. That has become so ingrained with not only the movie, but in whenever you talk about something about pirates, even when someone is doing something pirate related, you'll hear this song in the background somewhere.
Yeah. This song also got sampled in so much stuff.
Yeah.
And parodied in so many different ways. A rapper I like actually took a different part of the song and made it the chorus of one of his rap songs. That bit that's like dum dum da 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 dum dum dum, you know, that part is actually just the chorus to one of his songs. And when I was watching the movie, all I could hear were the lyrics that he had added to that. But he wrote it about being an internet pirate instead of the sailing the seas kind, which I love. But it has become just absolutely iconic.
Yeah. Like, you cannot do, if they do, and whenever they do another one, and you know they're going to do another one, that song has to be in there, even if you're not going to have Jack Sparrow in the movie.
Yeah. It does kind of start as Jack Sparrow's theme, and then it becomes the theme for the franchise.
Yeah.
To the point that music is now even in the ride, isn't it?
I'm pretty sure. Theme?
Yeah. I think that is in, and of course when they did, where was it? Disney in China, I think that they basically did Pirates of the Caribbean, except they did it mostly as a movie version.
Yeah, so Shanghai version, which was, again, Shanghai is a relatively recent park. Their version of Pirates of the Caribbean is completely based off the movies, since that's what their public would know. So it's just all characters from the films. You get more special effects from the film. They have a really amazing animatronic Davy Jones, which I wish they would somehow find a way to put that into the American rides.
They also use a lot of like LED screens and stuff to sink you under the ocean and have the feeling that you are, you know, traveling on the ocean floor.
Mm-hmm.
Through there. I've seen ride footage of going through it. It's really impressive. I wish I could experience it in person. This as a cultural phenomenon.
Yeah, who knew? I mean, we thought this movie was going to be a bomb, but it's just one of the more lucrative franchises Disney's ever made.
I am trying to think of another film that I was so certain was going to be garbage that ended up being good.
Yeah.
I mean, to this level, I thought that this was going to, like, you know, pardon the pun, but sink a few careers.
Yeah.
I really thought that this was like, well, Johnny Depp used to be a film star, you know? I really thought, like, Orlando Bloom's really ending his career right as it's getting started, because this was at the kind of crux of him being in Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
You know, this was like he could name his price and do any project he wanted. And this is what he picked, you know. Oh, man. I had so much fun mocking this film before it came out, and it really taught me. Not an entire lesson, because I still do it a little bit, but it kind of taught me to pull back my hatred for some of these things a little bit. Yeah.
Let's wrap this up with we have to talk about this, the pronunciation of Caribbean or Caribbean. Because in this movie, and even in when they released The Ride, they specifically say Caribbean. But the area, the correct pronunciation is Caribbean.
And the interesting thing is, I don't know about anybody else, but me personally, if I talk about the movie or the ride or the franchise or the concept of Pirates of the Caribbean, I say Pirates of the Caribbean. But if I talk about the geographical region, it's the Caribbean. And it has been since I was very young. I really didn't know anything about the Caribbean until Pirates of the Caribbean, you know? Mm-hmm. So I was like, oh, that's just the way it's pronounced. And then I saw like news stories or something like a hurricane hit or something when I was young. And every single one of the news people was saying it Caribbean. And I was like, wait, but at Disney? And my parents had to be like, well, Disney isn't the authority on everything. They will buy everything and they will be the authority on everything at some point.
For me, it was Sesame Street, Kermit the Frog seeking Caribbean amphibian. Back to Muppets. Yeah. It always comes back to Muppets.
I am the Caribbean amphibian. That would be very weird. But I think I heard Caribbean amphibian pretty close. And I was like, oh, I think maybe though with Kermit that I thought they had just changed the pronunciation for effect. Yeah, it's like, because sometimes you do that in music. You know, it would be a slant rhyme otherwise, so you mispronounce one of them kind of artistically to make it, you know. But so, when I hear news people do it, I'm like, oh, that must be the way it's really pronounced. But I find it interesting that this is one of the few words in my vocabulary that I will pronounce completely differently depending on context.
So let's ask the question. We don't really need to, but this movie definitely has the magic.
No question. Absolutely. This movie is great and brilliant and wonderful, and it made me so happy to watch it again.
And yeah, this Talk Like a Pirate Day this Saturday. Turn it on. Just watch, you know, put it on the background, sit down and watch it again. It's a good movie. It's, oh, just to come back to this movie again after so many years of having seen the sequels and not seen the original in a long time, I forgot how good it was.
Yeah, if you've got older children or younger children that wouldn't be scared by walking skeletons and stuff, because they are pretty impressively realistic walking skeletons.
This actually, I had to look this up, this is actually Disney's first PG-13 movie.
Huh. It really took them till 2003 to get a PG-13 movie?
Yeah, they were all PG, and you know, I mean, look how long it took them to get to a PG movie. Now this is straight Walt Disney Pictures. This is not counting Touchstone.
Yeah. Under the Disney brand.
Yes.
You know your kids better than we do, of course. Yeah. But you know, if you've got a younger one that can handle the kind of horror ghost story elements of it, they're not heavy, of course. But you know, if that visual's gonna scare them, skip this one. But you know, if you got an older kid or a particularly, you know, younger kid with good fortitude or something, it's a great family movie. There's not really anything super objectionable for most people.
Mm.
I wouldn't say, you know, I mean, it depends on how well you take to the idea of adults getting drunk or mild sexual references. Yeah. But there's not really anything I would feel awful showing a 12 or 13 year old, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. There's nothing wrong with that. So I think that's all we can say about that. Moving on to next week. When you think Disney and Pirates, now you think Captain Jack Sparrow. But before that, there was the OG Disney pirate, and that be Captain Hook. So we are going all the way back to the 50s. We are going to be talking about the original Peter Pan next week. Oh, that's the classic. This would be our first movie of the classic Walt era, I believe.
Yeah, I think it will be that our first dive into that original Walt era run of animation. Yeah.
Yeah. So check back with us next week for the original Disney version of Peter Pan. Happy Talk Like a Pirate Day to one and all. We'd like to once again thank Tom Smith, our good friend Tom Smith, for letting us use the song Talk Like a Pirate Day for these episodes. Check him out at tomsmithonline.com. Check him out if you haven't already. He's amazing.
Yeah, we love Tom.
And that's all about we can do about that. And we will talk to all of you next week. Bye.
Arr.
Most days are like all of the others. Go to work, come back home, watch TV. But brother, if I had me druthers, I'd chuck it and head out to sea. For I dream of the skull and the crossbones. I dream of the great day to come, when I dump the mundane for the old Spanish main and trade me computer for rum. Arr to me, yo ho, yo ho, it's Talk Like a Pirate Day. When laptops are benches, God gave us for wenches, and a sail ain't a low price to pay. When timbers are shivered and lilies are livered and every last buckle is swashed, we'll abandon our cars for a ship full of R's and pound back the grog till we're sloshed, yo ho.
Hey, anybody seen me keys?
Just off the coast of Florida, matey, R.
Don't pick up your phone and say hello. Our 10 o'clock meeting's delayed.
You scrunch up your face and you bellow. Avast, you've been bleeding belayed.
You can't keep this fun to yourself, I bet. So sing,
I-R-A,
every man.
We ain't got much grasp of the alphabet,
but a damn good retirement plan.
To me, yo-ho, yo-ho, it's Talk Like a Pirate Day. Whatever's in fashion is in for a thrashing, and being polite is passé. When it's every man's duty to grab his proud beauty and let out a hearty yo-ho. And if this offends you, hold your breath as we send you to Davy Jones' locker. You go, yo-ho.
Hey, where is Davy Jones' locker anyway?
Right near Monkey Island, matey.
We'll tell every banker he'd to unweigh anchor by latte with pieces of eight. We'll fight to be chosen as cap'n or bosun, the loser, of course, his worst mate. When we hoist Jolly Roger, the landlubber's dodger, we fill him with loathing and fear. We'll plunder and pillage each city and village,
or at least clean out Walmart of beer.
Ahoy, mateys, and welcome to Iron Chef Pirate. Let's see the secret ingredient. It's barnacles!
Oh, there'll be some cutting-edge cuisine.
Hold still, Polly. I need this for me salad.
Alas, there, me bucko, you need carrot shavings.
Oh, carrot.
but, Captain, I be an Atkins.
Oh, aye.
Moron.
And you, what are you doing with that salmon?
I'm grilling it on a hunk of cedar, what do you think?
You can't do that in a Japanese stir fry, you bilge rat.
Oh ho, you never heard of walking the plank?
There ain't no computing or morning commuting, no parking lot full signs for me. No lawns to be mowing or bills to be owing, I'm knowing the pull of the sea.
The fresh salty brace of the wind on my face through hurricanes, sunshine, or squalls. I'm keeping my eyes on the distant horizon. Verizon can hold all my calls.
To wear a red coat full of buckles, to earn a few dueling scars. Well, at least we can get a few chuckles by filling the office with ours. And maybe we'll never get closer than watching them on the big screen. So here's to old Errol and deaf as Jack Sparrow
and every damn one in between.
To me,
yo ho, yo ho, it's Talk Like a Pirate Day. That time in September when sea dogs remember that grown-ups still know how to play. When wenches are curvy and dogs are all scurvy
and a software patch covers your eye.
To hell with our jobs, for one day we're all swabs and buccaneers all till we die. So hoist up the mainsails and shut down your brain cells, they only would get in the way.
Avast there, me hearty, we're having a party.
It's Talk Like a Pirate Day. Yo-ho!
All right, me buckos, we've got a new retirement plan. What's it called, Captain?
A 401R.
Nice office, matey. Who designed it?
An architect.
I've got to stop at the store on me way home.
Where are you going, Target?
No, Marshall Fields.
Incoming message, Captain.
Alpha, Romeo, Romeo, Romeo.
Whose side are they on?
Our side, of course.
Now you're pushing it.
Oh, so I've gone too far.
Created a monster, I have.
No, 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 that's talking like Yoda.
Thank you for listening to Rewatching the Magic. We invite you to keep the magic going by joining the conversation online. Find us on Facebook at Rewatching the Magic, on Twitter at Rewatch the Magic, and of course, find all new episodes at rewatchingthemagic.podbean.com. Until next time, remember, the magic is for everyone. It only stops if you let it.